Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Middle East Studies. Our guest today is Elias Mohanna, who is the Manning Assistant Professor of Comparative Literature at Brown University. He earned his doctorate in Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations from Harvard University and has held fellowships from the American Council of Learned Societies and the Whiting Foundation. His research focuses on encyclopedic literature in the Islamic world and Europe, the cultural production of the Mamluk Empire, and the problem of the vernacular in different literary traditions. He is heavily involved in digital humanities. He edited the Digital Humanities and Islamic and Middle East Studies out from De Gruyter 2016. He's also the creator of the Digital Humanities Project at Brown, a multi-year initiative that convenes an annual conference and holds a variety of research activities. He's also a contributing writer for the New Yorker's online edition, and his essays and criticism have appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, Foreign Policy, and other periodicals. He has also translated and edited The Ultimate Ambition in the Arts of Erudition, out 2016 from Penguin. And his most recent book is titled The World in a Book, A Noaity and the Islamic Encyclopedic Tradition, out 2017 from Princeton University Press. Welcome to the podcast, Elias.
Thank you very much.
So what brought you to Al-Nuwaiti? To some extent, what's the intellectual history of your own work and your intellectual biography?
So here's the story. I was a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was taking my general exams, which at Penn was it's called a 50-book exam, where you have, it's kind of a Eurocentric thing where, you know, you have 50 texts, usually novels or selections of poetry or plays on this, you know, this list, and it's supposed to represent the canon of a given literature. So I was doing that with Roger Allen for Arabic. And so Roger had assembled a list like this. He had kind of made it work for Arabic for previous students, although I don't think very many had done it. I don't think there had been very many students in classical Arabic at Penn. So one of the items on the list was a selection from encyclopedic texts. So alongside the typical kinds of things you'd imagine to be on an Arabic canon exam, like, you know, mu'allaqat and maqamat and, you know, selections of poetry and various things right up into the modern period, so early novels and so on. There was also, you know, he just had like an item on the list that was like, well, some kind of representation of the encyclopedic literature of the Mamluk period. So one day I remember we went into Van Pelt Library together, because that item was blank still and we had to kind of round out the list. So we went up to the fifth floor at Van Pelt, maybe not, I don't remember. And we kind of walked up to this bookshelf that included Nuaidi's encyclopedia and other ones as well. And he kind of just, he was like, let's see. And he just pulled a random volume off the shelf. It was like volume 9 or something. And he kind of flipped to the middle of it and he said, okay, this looks good. How about, you know, do like 150 pages from this section. And I was like, okay. And I had no idea what was in it. I had no idea what this book was. I had no idea who the author was. But in the course of preparing for the exam, I, you know, I had to figure out who he was, what this book was. And I was just, really mesmerized by the material, which is odd because the material was on financial transactions and legal codes related to, like, if I remember correctly, it was related to maritime craft and, you know, the classification of different kinds of boats that you might find on the river and what happens if, you know, this person's property is affected by that person's property and how you determine blame and how you write up the contract, you know, rental agreements and all this stuff that, first of all, has nothing to do with literature. And second of all, I had no idea it existed. I mean, I wasn't even aware that we had this kind of material in the classical sources. And, you know, that's natural because I was like a second year graduate student. So I kind of filed that away in the back of my mind as like, as one of the highlights of my experience of studying for my generals, and a text that I had known nothing about. And I thought, you know, maybe this would make an interesting basis for a project down the line, like a dissertation project or an article or something. And then, you know, a year or two passed and I was in a different place. I was in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations at Harvard. And I was working with Wolfhard Heinrichs and Shahab Ahmed. And I remember the beginning of my second year, I was having a conversation with Shahab and he just, you know, abruptly, as he often did, kind of asked me, he just asked me out of the blue, so what is your dissertation project? And I said, I didn't want to say I didn't know. I had to come up with something on the spot. And for some reason, this project on Nuwaiti or this link to Nuwaiti kind of jumped into my mind. And I said, well, you know, I'm thinking one idea I've had is a dissertation about the encyclopedic literature of the Mamluk period. And he looked at me and he said, that's your dissertation project, unless proven otherwise. You shouldn't even look for a different one. Like, you should assume from this point on that that is what your dissertation project is, unless something much better comes along. But I have now decided for you that is, in fact, a worthy project, and that's what it should be. And I said, okay. And I kind of didn't think about anything else after that conversation. And I just began trying to familiarize myself with these texts. And because I had already read some of Nuwaiti, I guess I started with him and very quickly realized that this was a fascinating work and deserved a study of its own.
Yeah, that's a pretty common story, I feel. At some point, you throw an idea to a dissertation advisor and they're just like, yeah, that's a good idea. Go with it. Don't think of anything else.
Right.
And that's a good way of keeping you on track to some extent, because I know that that's always the fear, is that you'll get off track and you'll do something, or you'll imagine a project that's too big. And that's actually something I really appreciated about the book. And you say it's the beginning, that this is a very small book about a very big book.
Yeah.
So to take another step back before we get to the actual book itself, what was sort of the nature of knowledge in Mamluk Egypt? I understand it's a very big question. That's basically like asking you to explain to an alien what the liberal arts system in the US is like. So could you take a stab at that?
What do you mean by the nature of knowledge? Because I was kind of scratching my head when I read that question.
So I don't want to say the genealogy of knowledge, but sort of how would you describe knowledge production, perhaps? Mm-hmm. What different genres of knowledge exist? Because one word that I have often used to describe knowledge in the pre-modern period is the Islamic sciences, but I understand for a variety of reasons that that's not always appropriate.
Right. Okay. Well, it is a huge question. So maybe I'll try to domesticate it by focusing on the areas of knowledge that were of interest to Nuwaiti, and which is, you know, already a lot. It's many different spheres. But if you were to, you know, if you were giving a lecture to a supper club or to a undergraduate course, and you had one unit to kind of talk about this moment in world history, namely Egypt and Syria in the from the 13th to the 15th centuries and what the kind of knowledge landscape was like, then you would have to begin with probably the landscape of education. This is a time that is characterized in Islamic history by a kind of explosion of educational infrastructure. So what that means is that we have the establishment of madrasas that are, in the school cities of the Mamluk Empire, primarily Cairo and Damascus, but other places as well. And some of the, the statistics that we have are kind of astounding, like the number of madrasas, and not just madrasas, which are primarily, are primarily colleges of law, but also other educational institutions, places that taught hadith, Sufi lodges, other places where knowledge was transmitted. But even if you're to just focus on the madrasa scene, it was kind of an amazing time for that institution. For a variety of reasons, we see a kind of political economic situation emerge that makes it profitable, or that incentivizes the creation of charitable endowments, waqfs, to support these kinds of institutions. So wealthy patrons, members of the ruling class, the military administrative bureaucracy, but also just like wealthy merchants, would establish these charitable endowments that would provide the financial support for some kind of an institution. And, it could be a really small place, kind of like a small mosque with a little library attached that had enough funds to support, some charity activities for the poor, or it could be a huge mosque with a huge, mausoleum attached and a staff of, let's say 10 different professors, and then stipends for graduate students and a dormitory for them, money for the gardener to take care of the surrounding gardens, money for the the ox driver who powers the water wheel, then money for a librarian, money for books. So that's the kind of now those particular institutions were often connected to the state, often connected to the Sultan, and so that I think you'd have to begin with that particular infrastructural environment when you're talking about knowledge transmission in the Mamluk Empire. But beyond that, there are other milieus. There are, I kind of talk about this in the book, that there were other places where different kinds of knowledge, different sciences were transmitted. And, we have evidence to suggest that that hospitals played a role in that regard for what we would think of as the natural sciences, in other places too.
So specifically, I want to bring us to Al-Nuwayri, because this book is about an encyclopedia written by Al-Nuwayri, a rather large book. And he has I think you describe it as one point as a novice. But that's not quite uncommon during this period with regards to knowledge production, and it continues. So who was he? What was he amidst this context that you just laid out for us?
Yeah, so Nuwayri was he came from a family of bureaucrats, but he was born in Upper Egypt at the end, towards the end of the 13th century, last quarter of the 13th century. And at a pretty young age, he gets a big job in the Mamluk bureaucracy. So, I think he was like 19 or 20. When he landed his first job, and it was in an important office. So it seems likely that he would have had some kind of family connection that enabled him to get that job. But basically he spends the next, 15 to 20 years working for the state. And this is an important part of the story because the Mamluk bureaucracy grows, in the 13th to 14th centuries, into the 15th century, the bureaucracy becomes a very important part of the landscape. Many scholars, literateurs, poets, historians, work for the state. And this is like one of the big stories, certainly in, you know, one of the big kind of arguments in my book, but I think it's also one of the features of Mamluk intellectual culture, social history. And it's a part of that history that we don't really know very well. We all kind of take it for granted. As scholars of this period, we kind of we know this fact that like all of our major primary sources for this period, somewhere in their CV, it says, oh yeah, and he worked for, you know, the chancery, or he was in this DUN or that DUN. But there hasn't been a whole lot of work done on this question of how the fact of working for the state influenced your role as a, your profession as a hadith transmitter or as a historian or whatever. So Nuaidi is like, in this way, he's like totally unremarkable. He works for the state. He doesn't have a particularly like sexy job. He doesn't work for the chancery, which is where the intellectuals usually end up. The literateurs, the people who think of themselves as udaba, if you were a man of letters, you would sort of want to be in the chancery. That's where a lot of the famous people that we think of from this period usually worked. So he's like a financial drone for a decade and a half, a very powerful one. I mean, he worked in one of the most powerful offices in the government, which was the Diwan al-Khas, the Sultan's Bureau, the Privy Purse, which is basically like the Sultan's private, slush fund that he used to pay for his own land acquisitions and property acquisitions. And so Nuaidi was his man, and Nasir Muhammad, who was maybe the greatest or one of the sort of two or three top most important sultans of the Mamluk Empire, the longest reigning one, the one who really kind of established in many ways the kind of created the topography of Cairo as we know it. I mean, what we associate with Cairo is really goes back to the Mamluk period, and Nasir Muhammad was a builder. He was a real fan of monumental style construction, and so Nuaidi was close to him. He was one of his favorites, they had a falling out at some point, but he was essentially one of Nasir's men, and he was appointed to some important positions in Nasir's administration. And so anyway, after this, very celebrated career, which he could have stayed in and probably could have risen even higher. He was sort of on that path. At some point he decides to retire. And the way he puts it in the preface to his book is he realized that he wasn't getting any closer to adab. He wasn't really... his great passion was adab and literary erudition, and he felt that although he'd had a wonderful career in administration, and he says this like, I was the top, I was like the number one administrator, I was like a fire on a hilltop, I was I could have I was a contender, that sort of rhetoric. He said, I decided to give it up because I couldn't really glean the kind of knowledge that I wanted just from like circling, rubbing elbows with all these literateurs. I really had to kind of devote myself to study, to learn what I needed to learn, to become a kind of master of adab. So he said, and I needed a book to kind of accompany me. I needed to have a book to put all my stuff in, to gather all of my notes and all of the things that I thought were important. And so he styles his work as a compiler he kind of describes his book as it's almost like a commonplace book, as a place for him to put all of his accumulated clippings and things that he'd read in one place so he could see them all. So he began compiling the Nihaya Nihayat al-Arab fi Funun al-Adab is the full title, so which I translate as The Ultimate Ambition in the Arts of Erudition. He begins compiling that probably around 1314 or 1316, so towards the end of his career, still a very young man. He's working on it until the end of his life in 1333, primarily because the end of the encyclopedia is a chronicle, and so he just keeps adding to it until he dies.
So you describe this period as an explosion of universal compendiums, and it's interesting because I think you use the term universal compendium, but you also use the term encyclopedia. So generally, who were his contemporaries in terms of encyclopedias and universal compendiums? And specifically, why did you choose to use the term encyclopedia in multiple places and not universal compendium?
Okay. So this time period is it's a period of sort of growing books. I mean, the books are getting bigger. We're seeing more and more compilations. He was inspired, I think it seems clear that he was inspired by a work of his contemporary, one of his contemporaries, Al-Watwat, who was a bookseller and a copyist in Cairo, who, you know, was kind of like a polymath, somebody who knew something about everything because he sold books, and he was also a literateur, and he had written a four-volume encyclopedia that Nuwaiti basically used as the kind of the basis for the Nihaya, but then he added one more part to it, which was history. That's the part that's missing from Al-Watwat. There are other bits too that are missing, and I kind of go into it in the book. But you know, sort of, it's really after Nuwaiti that you begin to see encyclopedism kind of really take off in various genres. I mean, it had been there throughout all of classical Islamic thought. I mean, going all the way back as far as we go, we see compilations, we see classifications of knowledge. But this period is really kind of associated with this gargantuan, elephantine, you know, intellectually omnivorous kind of intellectual culture. And you know, definitely in the later part of the 14th century into the 15th century, we really see this take off. And so some of the famous works following the Nuwaiti are Ibn Fadlallah al-Amari's Masadik al-Absar, which is another, you know, that's like a, I want to say, 24 volume encyclopedia. And then you have Al-Kalkashandi Subh al-Asha, which is also a huge chancery encyclopedia. And then, of course, we have things like biographical dictionaries and encyclopedic chronicles. So to the question about, you know, how to describe all of this, the word encyclopedia, obviously, is a European word. It has an interesting history. It doesn't, you know, when it was coined, it didn't refer to the kinds of texts that we today think of as encyclopedic. It was coined, it was actually in a kind of an erroneous coinage. I mean, it was created by humanist scholars who modeled it on what they thought was an ancient Greek term, which they kind of misread. So, you know, it has a history in the Renaissance as denoting certain kinds of works, usually works that showed the connections between different branches of knowledge, but didn't kind of like, weren't these multi-volume reference texts that we, you know, today we think of an encyclopedia as this bulky thing that you have on the shelf that, is a reference text basically. So that only really happens, later on, you know, during the Enlightenment. So, you know, there is this question of, you know, how to refer to these texts that we see multiplying in the Mamluk period. Should we call them encyclopedias? What are the problems with that? Is there some other word that we should use? You know, I'm writing in English, so any term that I use is going to be foreign in some way or another, unless I choose to use an Arabic word. But even there, it's problematic. Like if I had said, I am not going to use a foreign term to denote these works, I wouldn't have a good choice among the Arabic ones either, because we don't have an equivalent from this period. Nuaidi did not, you know, refer to his text as, you know, like a mu'jam or a jami' or a mawsu'a. I mean, the mawsu'a is much later, is a modern term. And even if he had referred to, I mean, he really thought of it as a work of adab, even though most of it is history. So the generic categories, the kind of actors categories, are not very useful in at least in establishing like a single kind of paradigm or a single category that can be used to unite all these different works.
Do you think he intended it to be read as a piece of adab?
It's hard to know how he thought it should be read. I mean, there's evidence in the book to suggest that different kinds of reading practices would have been suitable. I think that the way he's organized it, I mean, it's so fastidious and it's so logically arranged, and he had such a clear idea of where he was going and what would be in the book and what would not be in the book, because you have this like very self-conscious system of cross-references within the book where he'll say, you know, he'll be talking about, for example, you know, elephants, and he'll say in the chapter, you know, on elephants, he'll say, and elephants have been used as weapons of war. You know, they've been used as like siege animals. And the most famous example of this is Mahmud of Ghazna, who used elephants during his siege of XYZ. And then he'll say, but if you want to learn more about this, then you need to check out this chapter where I discuss it. Instead of saying, and let me tell you that story, which was often the case, a lot of, you know, so-called encyclopedic literature, authors, you know, in the Islamic world and elsewhere, encyclopedic authors were known for kind of just rambling on and going off in lots of different directions. That's kind of like a staple or a signature of a lot of pre-modern encyclopedism, is that it's kind of like rhizomatic. It goes in different directions, and it's not highly hierarchical. Even if the plan looks hierarchical, the contents often are not. Whereas Nuaidi really was, you know, really anal about what was going to be in which box. So I think he did intend. I think he had a vision of people reading the book in a kind of consultative way, that, you know, if you're working in the chancery and you're writing a letter and you need some sort of a metaphor for a famous, I mean, let's say you're writing a couplet of some kind to put in a letter to some foreign governor or something, and you want to make reference to the sea, because his kingdom is on the shores of XYZ, and you want to make some sort of like an analogy between the boundlessness of his generosity and the boundlessness of the sea. And you want your couplet to make reference to some kind of famous image from Arabic poetry, because that is, you know, is a way of like heightening your own erudition or appearing to be, you know, more literate than you are, then you could reach for a Nuaidi's chapter on the sea and kind of quickly peruse the poetry that had been written on it. So I do think that he thought about things in that way.
Can you give us a sense of the overall architecture? I mean, you brought up elephants. We know elephants are in the book, but it's such a wide, like, as you mentioned, it is a very large book that you're actually a relatively large book is about. What's sort of the architecture of the encyclopedia?
The book has 33 volumes in its modern edition. In the manuscript, it's 31. So it's over 30 volumes long, about 9,000 pages. And my calculation is something like 2.3 million words. It's arranged, Nuaidi arranged it into five funun, so five arts or five books or, you know, whatever upper level structure. And so you've got the kind of like the universe, which is a kind of a cosmological thing. So, you know, heavens, earth, the different, like, you know, geography, that kind of stuff. And then you've got the human being, that's part two. And then animals, plants, and history. And then within each of those five funun, you have five aqsam, so five sections. And, you know, he breaks things down further. And then within each of those, there's a different number of chapters ranging from like 3 to 14. So it's sort of like a tree structure, which is a common way of organizing cosmographical compendia. And so my argument is he sort of takes that pattern, that structural pattern from the cosmographical tradition, and it applies it to a work of edup.
Can I just ask, how did you approach, I mean, did you read the whole thing? How did you approach such a large work?
Yeah. When I started working on it, I was living abroad, and I was living abroad for a year to be close to my family in Lebanon. And I approached it really in a sort of naive way, because I knew it was huge and I wanted to read as much of it as I could. And so I just said, all right, well, I have this many days, you know, that I've set aside for reading this year. And this is how many pages there are. And I'm just going to divide the number of pages by the number of days and go. So I think I set myself a daily quota of like reading 40 pages. So I would sit down in the morning and I would just read, and I would take notes and just try to get a sense of what was there. So by the end of the year, I had read, I don't know how many volumes, I'd read a lot. And I had notes on a lot of the stuff, but you know, some things I had skimmed, some things I had read very closely. But it had given me a sense of like of the contents and the contours of this work. And I knew which areas I could then go back and zoom in on. So, you know, that was the process of working on the dissertation. And then when I went back to the dissertation to start writing the book, you know, I had to kind of like start all over again. And so I, you know, reread my sources, discovered new parts of the encyclopedia that I hadn't actually read during my doctoral work because I wasn't focused on them. And, you know, and so there are parts of it that I've read, you know, probably dozens of times. And there's other parts I'm sure that I have never even looked at. But I'm confident that like, I would say 80% of it I've read. And when I worked on the translation of like the super abridged kind of like sort of an anthology of the work for Penguin, I had to, you know, obviously read that stuff all over again. So yeah, that's kind of my way of that's how I've interacted with it.
That's incredible. Wow, that's quite an achievement. So how did El-Nuwayri's work get from, you know, him finishing the book to you coming across into the library, Van Pelt Library, you know, 10, 15 years ago? What was the afterlife of the book, so to speak?
Yeah. So it in my monograph I kind of I go over its reception history. And my sense is that it was not, you know, because of its size, it was not copied in toto. You know, it would have been very rare for somebody to say, I'd like a copy, you know, to walk into a bookstore and say, I'd like a copy of Nihayat al-Arab, you know, that would have been hugely expensive to do. So my sense is that individual volumes of it circulated. And, you know, if someone were to want to kind of do another study of this text, you could kind of track the bits of it that were most interesting to people by checking out the manuscript record and getting a sense of like which volumes were copied most. So beginning in the Ottoman period, we start seeing there's a couple, you know, very well, there's at least one you know, an incredible copy of it. That's a 2-volume copy that must have been made for some very wealthy patron that is now at Leiden. And, you know, there's some evidence that it was considered, you know, that Ottoman viziers took an interest in it and had it copied because it was kind of like a summa of classical Arabic. But, you know, things get really interesting from my perspective when Europe discovers it. And so the final chapter of my book deals with that European reception. And the story there is really centered in Paris and in Leiden. When the French and the Dutch Orientalists start collecting Islamic manuscripts in the 17th century, this is one of the first things that makes its way to Europe. For some reason or another, it's like one of the, you know, the cornerstones of those early collections at the Bibliothèque de France. I mean, what was known then as the Bibliothèque du Roi, which became the BNF, and Leiden University's amazing collection of Arabic manuscripts, Arabic and Turkish and Persian manuscripts. So I kind of trace the interest of European Orientalists in this encyclopedic literature, and specifically Nuaidi, what they were hoping to get out of it, of that text, which parts they were interested in. And so from there, we kind of move forward in time to the Arab world's rediscovery of this encyclopedic legacy, and that kind of happens towards the end of the 19th century. And so the work begins, there's a kind of a movement in Egypt to reclaim Arab heritage in the form of manuscripts, and to assemble a national library, and to kind of launch, I mean, this is part of the Nahda and, you know, the renaissance of Arabic letters and thought. So the project to begin editing Nuaidi's work is really interesting. And a lot of what I know about is, you know, comes from research by Ahmed al-Shamsi, you know, who really kind of discovered that there was this fascinating, kind of like a subscription program that was launched to, you know, how you see like these, I don't know if people, if you still see these advertisements for like, you know, buy these coins, you know, there's like limited edition coins that you can buy, you know, like in airplane magazines, you can, you know, subscribe to certain, I don't know, like collections of the world. Maybe people don't do this anymore, but I think I remember when I was younger that you could like buy a subscription to like the World Library or the Great Classics or something. And then every, you know, a few months you'd get this new book. Something like that was happening with Nuaidi as a way of financing the edition of the text and its publication. And so it still took decades. I mean, the last volumes of the Nihaya were only published, I want to say like in the 60s. So it took decades and decades to publish the entire thing. And you know, then there was a re-edition, or there was kind of like a knockoff edition, and then of course it was digitized, and now it's online. And so yeah, that's kind of how I came to it.
So one thing I really admired about the book was, and I mentioned this earlier, is that you're very careful about your terms. I mean, encyclopedia and universal compendium are, it's one such example, but you focus so well on Mamluk Egypt. And I had a difficult time, and I think this is to the book's credit, orienting the book in Islamic studies or just general book history. It didn't feel like it was this classical Islamic studies, again, to its credit. And I think it reminded me very much of the debate that we've been having in the field of Islamic studies for quite a long time, which I often surmise as Islamic or Muslim, which, and you mentioned the late Shahab Ahmad, he sort of took that and published it in the form of What is Islam, which came out 2 or 3 years ago now. So what's your take on this? Sort of where do you fall along this debate? And also where do you orient your book?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can answer that question in a satisfying way. You might have to edit this out. I don't know. I mean, it's not a question that's really live to me. I think the Islamic versus Muslim debate, I mean, that maybe that's something that is a debate that it's much more vivid in religious studies departments or among scholars who are kind of really involved in projects that we assign to in our disciplinary mode to religious studies programs. I mean, my work is really falls pretty solidly in intellectual history, literary history, book history, you know, histories of knowledge. I mean, so the common term there is history. And I don't know. I guess I really didn't engage with questions of... as I think about it, I don't really engage all that much with questions that would be considered like the province of Islamic studies. You know, you could do that. I mean, I suppose you could write a book, certainly about encyclopedic culture, that really tackles these sorts of questions that Shahab was interested in What is Islam? Maybe you could even do it with Nuwaiti. I mean, I'm not sure that you could. I mean, he does have some material on Sharia, and there's a lot of hadith in the book. He was a hadith scholar, and he studied with some of the big names during his time. And he copied Bukhari Sahih 9 times and sold it for a lot of money. He was kind of known as somebody who produced these beautiful copies of Bukhari Sahih. But I don't know. I mean, one link that I do see between Shahab's interests and this project, maybe this is why he was interested in this project and, you know, served on my committee, is that, you know, a signature of Shahab's vision of Islam is that it's encyclopedic. He really sees the kind of substance of, like what he calls context in What is Islam. You could, if you wanted to, I mean, you could basically define it as like the encyclopedic legacy of Islamic thought. That's kind of what context is. And for him, you know, in the modern world, Islam is impoverished with regard to context. Muslims living today, because of modernity, because of the colonial intervention, because of, I mean, for lots of reasons, not just colonialism, he says that they have a much more, Muslims living today have a much more attenuated relationship to context, to what he calls context with a capital C. And it's because they're not embedded in this sort of discursive universe that somebody like a Nuwaiti would have been, or, you know, not even Nuwaiti, just like the average madrasa student living in Ottoman Edirne. I don't know, you know, having some kind of connection to this tradition. And when we say tradition, this is like one of Shahab's bugbears, his sort of pet peeves is, oh, increasingly today, because of what he calls like legal supremacism, we associate the tradition with law and hadith, and that's like what Islam is. But for him, it's like, no, it's not. Islam is encyclopedic. It's everything else in addition to the stuff that religious studies programs think of as properly Islamic. It's all the other stuff in a Nuwaiti's encyclopedia. It's the poetry and the cosmology and the literature and the lore and all the stuff that is, you know, precisely contradictory, the stuff that doesn't seem to fit within the frame of what we consider to be Islamic today. That for him is like, that's the substance of Islam. That's what's remarkable about it. And it's not incidental to it. It is, it's properly essential to what Islam is. So I think, I don't know, as I'm thinking about it, if he were alive today and you asked him, what is the, you know, if you had to kind of point to a paradigmatic text that, you know, that defines or that kind of encapsulates what your vision of context is or what your vision of that Islamic tradition is, you know, he might point to like Hafez's Divan, or he would probably talk about the Quran as being that text of contradiction. But I think that he would also, you know, on his top 10 list, he would probably say an encyclopedic text like Noades, because, you know, it has all of the, it has that multifaceted character.
Oh, I appreciate that answer. I think you did a wonderful job there. It's a very tricky question, I find, especially because he took 600 pages to articulate that. And when you boil it down to the way I did, Islamic or Muslim, I think it's a very pick this one or that one. So one thing I mentioned earlier is that you're very, very involved with digital humanities. I think to some extent, one could even call you a leader in modern Islamic and Middle East studies digital humanity fronts. So how has that come to bear on this project? What are you working on with regards to that right now? How do you see the current state of digital humanities in Islamic and Middle East studies?
Yeah, I have been involved with digital humanities in the Islamic context. I sort of feel myself retreating from it a little bit, not because of any intellectual misgivings. To the contrary, I think that things are tremendously exciting, and the future is very bright for that sort of scholarship in our field. And there are some wonderful people working in that field who have, you know, who are taking it in very exciting directions. Of course, Maxime Romanoff, Sarah Savant, Matt Miller. I probably should not list more people, otherwise I'm going to miss names, but there's all, you know, if you just take a look at the speaker lists of some of the folks who are working, who go to, you know, increasingly common conferences on this theme, you'll see, like, you know, there's some really exciting scholarship happening. I kind of got involved in DH as a, how do I put it? Like a sympathetic bystander. I don't know. I was involved in digital things really purely in a instrumental kind of way, going back to this, you know, famous course at Princeton that Michael Cook taught, which is a methodologies course in Islamic studies. And students, you know, in that course would frequently resort to these text databases to look up things that Professor Cook had set to as assignments to us. And so I had become, interested in these huge text depositories like Al-Warraq and Maktab al-Shamila, just as like tools of my trade sort of thing. And then when I was working on Nuwaiti, because, you know, it's a huge work, I used, because I had a digital text version, you know, I would use things like regular expressions and word searches to kind of just make sense of what was there. Statistical sorts of manipulations of the document. And then, you know, when I came to Brown, I thought, hey, why don't we try to get something going here? Let's have a conference and see what's out there. So this conference that we held in 2013 at Brown, which became the first of like several conferences that we would organize, I think was the first conference devoted, I mean, I could be wrong about this, but I think it was the first one devoted to the digital humanities and Islamic and Middle East studies. And a volume came out of that. But I mean, that was only, 2013. So that was 5 years ago. And in 5 years, I mean, it's just exploded. The number of things that are happening, projects that are underway. Of course, that was all happening before 2013. So that was kind of the point of the conference, to see what was out there. So, to shine a light on it and to kind of maybe make it into a thing, make it into a give it an address, not a physical address, but give it a sort of a rubric and make people aware of what everybody else is doing. And so since then, I think Islamic digital humanities has kind of coalesced into an exciting subfield. And there have been, you know, major grants awarded, ERC grants, National Endowment for the Humanities grants, I want to say, to support some really exciting projects.
Yeah. I just want to congratulate one more time on the book. It's actually a very physically beautiful book too, in addition to being just a wonderful read. But I always sort of ask at the end of interviews, what are you working on now? Can you give us a bit of a teaser? I also know that you write prolifically for the New Yorker and the New York Times.
Yeah. So I am very busy with the public writing stuff, and that's something I enjoy, and, you know, I'll hopefully continue doing that. So that's, you know, that's easily, I would say, I don't want to say what percentage of my time, but a good chunk of my time is taken up by that sort of writing. And let's see what else. So I'm working on two other projects right now. One of them is a translation for the Library of Arabic Literature. I'm working with another scholar who's preparing the edition. And we're translating this 18th century travelogue. And so that's been a lot of fun. I've been working on that this year. And I imagine that will come out probably in 2020. And then I'm also working on a new book, which relates to, the problem of the vernacular in, Arabic literary history and Islamic thought to some extent. Or just maybe not Islamic thought, but, you know, let's say Arabic literary history and thought, and social history to some extent. So that looks at, you know, Middle Arabic, looks at non-standard forms of Arabic, in the kind of early modern period into the modern world, and, tries to kind of reconstruct debates about what it meant to have a modern, what it meant to be a modern society vis-a-vis language, putting that into context with other world regions that were kind of going through or experiencing vernacularization movements. So that's kind of what that book is about.
Well, congratulations on the book, and thank you for having a lovely conversation with me.
Thank you.